The following talk is part of a seminar held by the Madison Institute in honor of its founder, Midge Miller, who died in April 2009. Midge was a member of the Wisconsin legislature from 1970 to 1985 and worked tirelessly on progressive politics for the remainder of her life. This event, Progressive Vision, Progressive Voices, featured Jane Ann Morris, author and corporate anthropologist. She speaks on how corporations use the Constitution. This event was held in Madison on May 1, 2010. Jane Ann Morris.
I'm feeling especially constitutional these days, not only because of this event, but also because I'm involved right now in one of the longest standing constitutional conventions this nation has. I'll give you a hint. It's happened every decade since 1790. The census. The census is really visible. And I think there's enough discussion about it that many people actually understand what it's for. And I wish that were also true of other aspects of our Constitution, such as its application to corporations. But I think that through the actions of organizations such as the Madison Institute and people like Midge Miller, I think this may be beginning. Now, I did not know Midge Miller well, but I met her in the late 1990s through her efforts at the Madison Institute to bring the program on corporations, law, and democracy to Madison to talk about how corporations use the Constitution to dismantle democracy. Today, in a world where corporations not only cause most of the problems, all too often they're the ones who are framing the alternatives, which we then debate dutifully. We're missing out on better alternatives if there's no one to keep them alive. And a recent example is the healthcare debate, where the best alternative, single payer, was basically put in solitary confinement for the duration of the debate. If people didn't look outside the current debate, they might not even know that single payer exists in many places, in many forms. So somebody has to keep that alive. And it's in the spirit of that really broad inquiry that I'm offering my comments today. I think we live in a kind of democracy theme park, with lots of bells and whistles and flapping flags and no shortage of procedures. But for most of us, the levers really aren't connected to very much. In contrast, if you think of the relative few, you can think corporate lobbyists, they wield the levers that actually get something done. They move the world. And that starts with actually, literally, writing much of our legislation, or at the very least, having an unofficial veto power over it. Now, in my 15 years of reading corporate law, which overlaps almost completely with constitutional law, and that's not an accident, I learned how corporations essentially invaded the Constitution like retroviruses, and then used it to frustrate people, governments, and the possibility of democracy. They've gotten extremely good, corporations have, at figuring out ways of getting rid of laws they don't like by getting them declared unconstitutional. There are two main ways of doing this, and I'm going to discuss each one. One of them is by getting the judiciary to buy into a novel interpretation of a clause in the Constitution, and the second is by using so-called corporate constitutional rights, which has been discussed recently, usually under the rubric of corporate personhood. I've been asked to talk about those two, and I'm going to do it with reference to two current topics. One is Obamacare, and the second is the recent Citizens United Supreme Court decision. I'm going to do Obamacare first. But of course, we have to put this in a pretty broad perspective. States have often been called in our nation the laboratories of democracy for policies and legislation. People can try them out and see how they work. There's at least two positive aspects of this. One is that obviously states are different in problems, resources, ethnicity, climate. Just think about how specific speed limits are, and that's a good thing. Second reason states can be good laboratories of democracy is that, well, bad ideas, whereas ideas that work might be picked up both by other states and by the federal government. Like, look what they're doing over there. Now, in the last 150 years ago, states have passed many really great green laws, and I use the word green in a broad sense, not just ecological and environmental, but labor, human rights, civil rights, and so on. And frankly, many of them are much, much better than what we have today. They're really neat. I was surprised because in writing my latest book, I read through many, many of them. And these state laws really did slow down corporations, if not stopping them in their tracks. And the corporations hated these laws, and they searched the Constitution for a way to get them voided. Shortly after the census of 1870, corporate counsel found a clause in the Constitution that was starting to work. They found a way of voiding all kinds of laws by saying they interfered with the Commerce Clause, which says only, that's a clause in the Constitution, that Congress has the power to regulate trade among the states. And they found, corporations found, that they could go to federal courts and point to state laws which were annoying them in various ways and say, that's a trade barrier, that's an interference with interstate commerce. And I'm not going to give you too many examples, but there are hundreds of them. I'll just give you some of the topics. For example, laws in states that strongly protected water resources were declared trade barriers and unconstitutional. Laws that regulated and put conditions on the export of water, same thing. Interference with the Commerce Clause, trade barrier, unconstitutional. Many, many laws requiring serious labeling of things. Occupational safety, transportation safety, especially on the railroads and the roads. Outright bans on certain corporate practices were also declared unconstitutional at the urging of corporate counsel by the Supreme Court as trade barriers. Same with laws about worker protection, and I don't mean just on the job, also wages and pension guarantees. States passed laws to protect their economies against outsiders, to protect themselves against chain stores and the like. These were also thrown out as trade barriers. Consumer protection standards on things like meat and butter, important then, still important. Laws about keeping out sick cows and so on. So all kinds of laws that we might have had and we might be living under them or their descendants today were thrown out as trade barriers using this one clause in the Constitution. So that's one of the ways that corporations can use a clause in the Constitution to throw out laws that are regulating or controlling them. It's a vague and ambiguous clause. It's been used as a tool to protect corporations against the states that created them. Now, that's just one clause in the Constitution. There are a handful that are used in similar ways, and I'm not going to touch on them now. But when we're in a situation where all these really good laws can be thrown out as unconstitutional on really vague and convoluted grounds, that makes me feel like we're in some kind of a democracy theme park, because we can pass the laws all right, but then the ones that in fact offer the most resistance to corporate expansion or other corporate policies can be declared unconstitutional. But that's just one side of the Commerce Clause. This other side is directly to do with Obamacare. Now, Congress and the federal government have only the powers granted them by the Constitution. The rest are left to the states and the people. So when Congress passes a law, it has to peg it onto some clause in the Constitution that gives it that power. And that helps guard against having a federal court declare the law unconstitutional. The same Commerce Clause that was used as an excuse to throw out state laws as trade barriers, I hope you recognize this is an identical procedure and probably the dry run for WTO and NAFTA. But that same Commerce Clause became a very popular peg for federal legislation in the 20th century. That's not necessarily a bad thing. The National Labor Relations Act was totally pegged to the Commerce Clause, although that was a controversial decision. Many people wanted to link it to the Civil War amendments, the General Welfare Clause, and other things having to do with rights, worker rights, and so on, but it was pegged to commerce. Much of the civil rights legislation of the 20th century was pegged to commerce, and in fact, many of the landmark cases were decided on the basis of commerce, not necessarily civil rights. Many of the environmental laws, especially those passed since the census of 1970, and you remember that large bunch of environmental laws, the language and application of those laws is very much dependent on this same clause. In fact, when someone questioned whether the United States had the power to build the Panama Canal and they needed a constitutional clause to hang it on, they picked the Commerce Clause. So a 1906 court case says that the United States had the power to build that because of commerce. In fact, the use of this clause has become so broad and widespread that law journals have begun to refer to it as the "Hey, you can do whatever you want" clause. I shorten that to the "Hey, whatever" clause. By the late 20th century, people were using the phrase "giggle test" to pass to these convoluted justifications for it. So there we stood at the end of the 20th century, seeing that most of the progressive agenda, labor, civil rights, environment, so on, was in fact pegged to the Commerce Clause, not to much more obvious clauses, or to basic human rights. Then in 1995, the Supreme Court started dropping the other shoe. In three cases between 1995 and 2000, you may remember them, Lopez case, the Prince case, and the Morrison case, having to do with guns, schools, and violence against women, the Supreme Court basically said, you know what, we're not going to let you do that anymore. And they sort of gave notice that this vast amount of legislation pegged to the Commerce Clause on, frankly, fairly humorous kinds of convoluted arguments in many cases, was going to be vulnerable, and they weren't going to let it pass so easily anymore. This includes, by the way, the Clean Water Act, which you may have read about recently, as perhaps on the edge of having its applicability vastly reduced, and that's because of something called the reasonable bird rule, which I'm not going to go into now. It has to do with whether a reasonable bird flying interstate on its regular migration might consider stopping in a wet place in a farmer's field. And it's a really precarious situation to have so much really important legislation pegged onto something, the Commerce Clause, which is now so vulnerable. So we're finally getting to Obamacare. That Health Care Act, where do you suppose it was pegged? It was pegged very clearly to the Commerce Clause, and I actually brought some of the printout from that. As we all know, the right wing is very openly going against the constitutionality of Obamacare, using exactly the same arguments that worked in those three cases between 1995 and 2000. And as I mentioned, a lot of other progressive legislation is pegged to this. So that is the second way a clause of a constitution can be used to protect corporations. So to summarize, in this case, with this clause, it was claimed that the Commerce Clause was way too broad in granting powers to Congress to allow states to do good things. But on the other hand, the Commerce Clause is too narrow to support the kind of progressive legislation that we have pegged to it. Now, this is obviously a heads I win, tails you lose sort of approach, and it's been working for corporations for over a century. So that was the first way that corporations can use clauses in the Constitution, to get rid of state laws and to claim that because they're overbroad, and then to get rid of federal laws by claiming that there's not enough in the Constitution to peg it to. And now I want to talk about the other way, which you've probably heard a little more about. It's been referred to as corporate personhood. This refers to the fact that corporations are considered persons under the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses of the 14th Amendment. And through that kind of a gateway right, and it was called a right, they have gained many other constitutional protections as well. And Wisconsin is kind of a microcosm of the history of constitutional law. And so I'm going to go back to some examples from Wisconsin. It's really useful to kind of go through a historic wormhole and come out and look at what corporate law used to be. And I'm going to read you some of the provisions that are true of early Wisconsin law. A corporation was required to have a clear purpose, to be fulfilled but not exceeded. If they exceeded it or they didn't fulfill it, their licenses to do business were revoked by the state legislature in the early years without any participation by courts. The state legislature, in fact, could revoke a corporate charter for even no reason at all, and that's a direct quote. Corporate directors, officers, and agents could be held criminally liable for violating the law. Corporations often had to have their headquarters and meetings in the state where the principal business was. Corporate charters were usually granted for a period of time, 5, 10, 20, 30 years, depending, and they could be renewed or not by the legislature again. Corporations were prohibited from owning stock in other corporations, and if they can't do that, most of antitrust is not a problem. Corporations' real estate holdings were limited to what was necessary to carry out their specific purpose. They were prohibited from making political contributions, direct or indirect, and all corporation records and documents were open to the legislature or the state attorney general. Okay, so let's think what kind of entities corporations were if those were the conditions under which they were established. They were not independent political entities with opinions. They were not members of a community. They were not sponsors. There was no muddying of their role in a society as something created by a state for something recognized as a state purpose. Now, what happened to these laws about corporations that specifically gave them a purpose, a job, and made them revocable quite easily by the legislature? Well, what happens was that the corporate council went back to the Constitution with sort of another set of glasses on, and they found things that came to be regarded as corporate rights. Between the 1880 and 1890 census, there were three cases involving the 14th Amendment, and these three cases essentially claimed and granted corporations the status in law of persons for the purposes of having equal protection and due process rights. This means they can complain about discrimination and appeal. In the early 20th century, the Fourth Amendment was added to that, protections against searches and seizures, keeping OSHA out of your factory, and so on, based on a right of a corporation. And by the 1970s, increasing so-called free speech rights for corporations were recognized and enlarged, culminating in a number of campaign reform cases. So today we're in a situation where corporations can and have used the Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment to seek damages from local governments by saying that the corporations have been discriminated against. That's what you get with a bucket of due process. You can claim I've been discriminated against. And in this case, the I there was a fictive legal entity, a corporation, and not a person. So with that background, I actually read through Wisconsin's, I don't recommend it, campaign laws from about 1905 to the present, so I could get the big picture on it. And there's a quote you've probably heard, and I've been using it for over a decade, but it's out of a 1905 law. And think of what you have to have in your head about what a corporation is to write this. No corporation doing business in this state shall pay or contribute or offer consent or agree to pay or contribute directly or indirectly any money, property, free service of its officers or employees or thing of value to any political party, organization, committee, or individual for any political purpose whatsoever or for the purpose of influencing legislation of any kind or to promote or defeat the candidacy of any person for nomination, appointment, or election to any political office. Now, that makes you feel really good, but that was just the beginning of what the law was like at that time. It included if a corporation violated the law, if that corporation were chartered in Wisconsin, its charter could be revoked. They did require a court by that time. If it was a corporation from another state, known as a foreign corporation, it could be its permission to do business in the state could be revoked. There were prison terms, 1 to 5 years. There were large fines. And I figured out the present value of the fines, and one of them was $100,000. So those people really had an idea of what a corporation was, and they remembered that it is something created by a state. And I think since then, little by little, and you can read over all those laws too, by the way, the current versions assume that PACs, political action committees, are okay, assume that you can have voluntary groups, that the corporation, of course, can have publications and talk about elections. The fines, in most cases, are smaller and are linked to intent, which is very toughy. And there's no more sense that a corporation is not a participant in the democratic process. It's more about registering, disclosure, and so on, which I am in favor of, but the whole sense of the early law is lost. So it's more than a weakening of the law. It's kind of a cultural change. What is a corporation? The idea of what that is has changed from in the early days of corporate law in Wisconsin and in most states that are as old as Wisconsin. Corporations are instruments of the state. They're a chip off the block of state power because state has empowered them to carry out a certain task. They have powers because the state has given them powers, not because they have rights. The corporations operate at the pleasure of the people, acting through their legislature. They have no role in the political process. And if they play a role in the political process, that's called bribery and corruption. They're not members of the community, not partners, sponsors, and so on. Corporations are the results of a democratic process. They're not participants in it. So I want to talk a little bit about where the Citizens United case fits into this, and I wrote a short article on it. The Citizens United case, the recent campaign reform case, voids a 1990 decision called Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and it also voids parts of the Michigan law. This Michigan law was paid close attention to because it did retain a scrap of real regulation of corporations in that certain kinds of nonprofit corporations were prohibited from spending general funds to support or oppose a candidate. And that's not unimportant, but it's a tiny piece of what the laws used to reflect. This Michigan law also specifically defined person to include corporation. Okay? And that part wasn't questioned in the case. In the Austin case itself, the one that was thrown out, that Austin case, it's better than we have today, but I want to show you how limited it is compared to the attitude people used to have about corporations. The Austin case accepts that money equals speech. It accepts that corporations can spend treasury funds on initiatives and referendums. It accepts that PACs using segregated funds are legal and constitutional. It affirms that corporations are persons with constitutional rights, including First Amendment speech rights, 14th Amendment equal protection rights. Okay, that's corporate personhood, which is thoroughly ingrained in our laws. I agree that the recent decision makes things worse, but not even the dissent comes close to talking about the previous sense of what a corporation is. So a lot of people don't want to find that they're limiting free speech in any way. So let me just explain briefly what is happening when a corporation exercises free speech. This means that a corporation, an entity created by and given power by a state, has free speech rights. Now, who decides what a corporation thinks, whether it supports the opera or what candidate it prefers? We all know it's a small number of people, call them corporate management, let's say 20 people. Not the workers, not the employees, not consumers, not people who use its services, not the community surrounding the corporate facilities, and pretty much not the stockholders. We have a tiny group of people who control the corporation who decides what a corporation's opinions are. Then they use all the might and resources of the state-created corporation to spread their views and magnify them. That's what corporate free speech is. It states giving power to a few people who set up a money-making machine that exercises some of the powers of government, and the end result is amplifying the views of the few who control the corporation. And that's only possible because corporate personhood and the actual granting of constitutional rights to corporations has been around for about a century. Now, I want to just step back a minute and remind all of us of something that I know you all know, but constitutional rights, the ones that I'm naming, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, many, many, many lives were lost in the struggles, long, horrible struggles, for getting those rights for people. And now we're in a situation where these rights are taken over by corporations and exercised to enhance the power of a few against the states that created them and against the interests of the people that are supposedly represented there. I want to read a short quote from Justice Black's 1938 dissent, where he talks about how the 14th Amendment, that many of us thought was about human beings, has been used. Of the cases in this court in which the 14th Amendment was applied during the first 50 years after its adoption, less than one-half of 1% invoked it in protection of the Negro race, and more than 50% asked that its benefits be extended to corporations. Now, I want to say this about corporations having powers. You know, I think it's reasonable and appropriate that corporations have some powers, but they should be called powers. We should say, you have the power to build something there. You have the power to go to court on this. We don't need to call it a right. It really confuses everything and lets them slip in under the rights banner into the Constitution by calling them rights. So many of these things can be allowed simply as powers. Now, I've said that I think we live in a democracy theme park, and many of the bandwagons that I referred to earlier are part of that, and some are not. How will we know? I would like to suggest that one way is we can ask ourselves if we're acting as though corporations really did have opinions and rights. And if we forget that legislatures and laws actually give them the power, then we are in the democracy theme park. We can see in the Citizens United case what a change there's been from a time when the early laws, like I read to you about Wisconsin, recognized that corporations are creations of the state, literally, and that they do not have a role in the political process, which is for all people, even corporate executives, but as people, not as people who wield the great power of a corporation in the political process. I also want to say that the kind of changes I think we need to make can be incremental, because if you read the last 150 years of corporate and constitutional law, we got here incrementally. We can get out of it incrementally, and I hope it goes a little faster. But, you know, we actually have a map before us if we look at the history of how we get into that. I say that because I also want to emphasize that not every small step is an incremental step. Small and incremental don't mean the same thing. Incremental means adding toward a particular end, which, among other things, I would like to see be removing constitutional protections from corporations. So we've talked a lot about courts. And courts, in fact, play a huge role in that, and I think it's usually how a lot of these corporate rights and protections got started or actually got implemented. But frankly, personhood is not just in court cases. It's in every nook and cranny of the law. And I'm just going to give you an example here. You're probably aware that Delaware, more than half the Fortune 500 countries are chartered in Delaware for a lot of reasons we don't need to go into here. And here's Delaware's corporate code. It's just a law. And in it, they clearly say person and whoever, respectively, include corporations, companies, associations. So it's usually defined in the law like this. So this is where you find this. After it appeared in court, it was written into law. Now, of course, we would never do anything like that in Wisconsin, right? Here's Wisconsin's. Now, Wisconsin does it a little indirectly, because they say person includes an individual and an entity, and then you have to look up and see what entity includes, and that's where your list of corporations is. So my point here is we need to look at the courts to see what they're doing, but we need to look to our legislatures. So if you know any legislators, speak to them about that, because it's in the legislatures where the corporate codes are written, and they line up not only this personhood thing, but many of the other powers and rights are repeated in the corporate code. Now, with single payer, I'm convinced that almost anyone who understands it would prefer it to current reforms. And I think the same is true of constitutional protections for corporations. But it's not a one-liner to explain to people. I think we need to spend a lot of time explaining to our federal citizens how it's happening. And if people knew, I don't think they'd go with it. And I also would like us to recapture some of the sense from the early days of Wisconsin's statehood and corporate law that corporations are properly not participants in the political process, but the closely controlled results of it. And then I think we need to act on that by removing corporate constitutional protections. My final point is another reminder that our ultimate goal is not to defeat opponents, but convince them so they're no longer opponents. And in order to do this, we have to understand the constitutional protections for corporations ourselves. And we have to spread that understanding well beyond our immediate friends and allies. So I hope that in the spirit of Midge Miller's work, that the Madison Institute will continue its efforts in this direction. Thanks for the question.
We just heard from Jane Ann Morris speaking on how corporations use the Constitution as part of a seminar sponsored by the Madison Institute in honor of its founder, Midge Miller. Audio recordings of this and many other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsor.